her. I think you were probably one of the first people I met with in terms of lenders when I had started my journey in this industry and sort of went out there, started meeting lenders, thinking like, I'll go meet some people and see if I can work out what this stuff's all about. And I probably sat there and did lots of nodding and lots of pretending that I knew that you, what you were talking about. The branding and marketing gave you this image of this hugely successful business, which is hugely, you know, well experienced in all these sorts of scenarios. But really, when you had a look under the hood, there was a kind of lots of young people who sort of didn't have the experience to know exactly the right way to deal with things. But what we did have was drive. We got to the stage where we maybe outgrown the place, or not, you know, necessarily in terms of ability, but just in terms of a challenge. And so we always sat down and said, look, let's, you know, let's do something ourselves.
Welcome to the Property Funder podcast. I'm here today with Callum Taylor. Callum left university with a degree in accounting and finance in 2015, and he nearly joined an accountancy firm until, by his own admission, an interaction on the golf course, where else, if you know Callum, in 2016, led to him quickly pivoting and starting out in the property finance industry, entering a brokerage right at the bottom with almost no knowledge of what a mortgage was, and certainly no idea what a bridging loan was. Callum spent nearly 4 years working his way up before opening a central London office for that brokerage, and then left them 2 years later to launch Portway Finance in 2021. Outside of work, Callum is an avid golfer. Where else would you find him? And an Arsenal fan. He also loves his food and his wine. And if you go and follow Callum on Instagram, as I do, Callum spends a lot of time drinking very expensive red wine and very, very nice steaks. Anyway, Callum, it's a pleasure to have you here with us.
Michael, thank you.
We've known each other actually a very long time. I think we're definitely since probably mid 2016. So you were, you know, definitely a sort of knee high in brokering at the time. So not long after you joined Ennis, I think, that we got to know you. So it's good to have you here. You know, bit of a meteoric rise, some might say. Well, just for the audience's benefit, we're going to try and do this recording as two parts. So we're going to start focus on your career up to now and the direction for the future, and then we'll have a bit more of a fun, playful episode second time around. So look, talk us through the beginning, first of all, accounting and finance.
Not the most exciting.
How did you even get into that as a degree?
I mean, maybe that, you know, first of all, thank you for having me. You know, honored to be asked. I've seen many of your clips on Instagram and so on. I thought, God, when will he eventually ask me? and I think very interestingly, you mentioned, I think you were probably one of the first people I met with in terms of lenders when I had started my journey in this industry and sort of went out there, started meeting lenders, thinking like, I'll go meet some people and see if I can work out what this stuff's all about. And I probably sat there and did lots of nodding and lots of pretending that I knew that you, what you were talking about. But I think, interestingly enough, that was probably a similar time to you starting your
Avonmore
journey.
We were pretty early in our journey. We founded, this is our 10th year, right? So we would have been about a year old or less as a business when we met you. So yeah, I mean, we were as clueless as you were probably at the time.
You sounded like you knew what you were talking about. But yeah, like, look, taking, you know, rewind my life back to kind of early-ish days. My father was in the military. I went to boarding school from a very, very early age. I always wind my parents up that I call it 6 years old, but I think it was seven going on eight very quickly starting in September. But I had, you know, a really great time. I loved boarding school. I loved what was living with mates. I think it gave me a very good grounding and a very good early ability to look after myself, to decide that, look, someone's not going to do that for you. Go and look after yourself doing it. And, you know, I wouldn't change that for the world. A lot of people kind of say to me, like, when you say, oh, I went to boarding school at this age, they kind of think, oh, poor you, a lot of the response I get, sort of thing.
I want to ask that because actually I was at my kid's school for a sports match on Wednesday, and the question was asked of me, do I think that children who go to private school or have a private education, are they just naturally more confident? And my response to that was absolutely yes. I mean, I had a girlfriend in the first year of university. You know, I was privately educated. She went to state school, albeit in a, you know, in Parpenden. So not exactly, you know, she wasn't exactly slumming it. But there was a, you know, you could see when she was hanging out with the girls who went to private school that, you know, even though they were playing on the same hockey team or whatever, mm-hmm. you could see that there was a big difference. You could see that she shrank into within herself because she just, you know, I think there's something about going to private school that in my opinion, naturally, you know, gives you a bit of confidence that you might not benefit from unless it was natural to you, for example.
I agree. And I think especially boarding, I think there's nowhere kind of to hide. You know, you're there all the time. You can be quiet. You can go home to your kind of, you know, home, safe space, whatever. Nothing wrong with that. But you can kind of go back into your shell, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Be in your shell and then go home and kind of quietly go about your own business. I think it forces you to make relationships. It forces you to make friends. And sort of on a deeper level, I think, you know, some of my best friends, pretty much all of my friends are from school. You know, played sport with those people. I didn't go to kind of external sports clubs, things like that, that, that people do. But I kind of had a journey as well, which was, you know, talking of a confidence point of view, was an interesting one where I was one of only, when I started boarding at this school called Taunton School, fantastic school, had a brilliant time. I was one of only two boarders in my year, so it was, which was, you know, fair enough. It wasn't the biggest school, it wasn't the largest number of boarders, especially at that age. People tend to come in to boarding, I guess, maybe around the age of 10 or just before GCSEs or what have you.
I mean, seven's still pretty brutal, right?
Yeah. But my sister was there and, you know, funnily enough, she hated every minute of it. She couldn't wait to go home. And my parents had to call her to get me to talk to me because I was just so busy, you know, running around, smashing a cricket ball, football, whatever it might have been. Wasn't any golf at that stage quite yet. Maybe I should have got on that earlier. I might not have had such a failed career. But I was kind of, so I was in there very, very early, and I would say I was probably a big fish in a fairly small pond.
Yeah.
In terms of like everyone joined, therefore I was the one that had been there for the longest. Everyone looked up to me, kind of thing. And naturally, I mean, I've always been a fairly large person, so probably personality as well. And then that kind of changed very, very quickly for me. When I got to 16, I'd probably got in enough trouble at that school, caused enough problems, and had a really good opportunity to go and pursue a sports scholarship at a very, very well-known school, especially for sport. And so I took that opportunity, but very, very quickly, I was then joining an environment that had probably in total, I think there's about 1,500 boarders at that school. You know, they'd all forged relationships through the kind of age of 13 to then coming in at the age of 16, going on 17. Everyone really has their relationships and you just kind of like, you a little bit start again. So that was kind of an interesting experience.
You were like the Johnny Come Lately, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's worse is that, I mean, this is presumably another school in Somerset. So
Yeah. A school called Milford.
Yeah.
Brilliant school. And even still some of my friends today joke with me and say kind of, you know, we founded you. If we hadn't found you, you'd still have been just out there hitting golf balls and no one would have known who you were kind of thing. But that was like an interesting experience. But, you know, I got exposed to some incredible different experiences, you know, different opportunities. And that was really, really good. And actually, I suppose partly why I am today is one of those friends was someone that introduced me after university to an accountancy firm. And this accountancy firm kind of said to me, look, yeah, come in, you know, come under our wing. You can finish your ACA with us, blah, blah, blah. We're having a golf day on whatever date it was. Come along. So I came along to that. And, you know, at that stage, skipping out a bit where I sort of wanted, my dream was always to be a professional golfer, never quite made it. So came back to London, went to university here. And then worked here a bit while at university until kind of realizing that I probably needed to get a proper job at some stage. So, you know, as ironic as it sounds, I was having a sausage roll and a beer at the halfway hut through this golf day. And I met this guy, a great guy, who was actually the interim sales director at Ennis for a small period of time. And he essentially looked at me and said, "You don't want to do that. That's dull. Yeah, that's boring." And I thought to myself, "Yeah, everyone has said accountants are quite boring people," but I didn't have any other qualifications or idea how to kind of, you know, get somewhere. I always wanted to achieve something, but how to do that from what I knew seemed quite difficult. So I thought, at least I can do this for a bit and then maybe try and do something else. And that was really that. And I think very, very quickly I started working for them and right at the bottom and sort of got into the industry that way. And then, you know, met you and everything changed.
it's interesting one because like knowing you quite a bit now, obviously over the years, the idea of you being an accountant sort of makes me laugh because, you know, there's nothing against accountants. I think that, but a lot of people go through the accountancy qualification process, but ultimately they leave it because that professional qualification acts as a springboard for them to do things in other industries. But ultimately, yeah, I'm just knowing you a bit, I think you're too outgoing and your personality, I don't think you even made it through the exams to get your ACA.
I was going to say to you, the first thing I would say is I'm not intelligent enough to be one either. I maybe can come across as intelligent in terms of numbers. Like I always struggled like reading at school. Reading was never my thing. I probably could on one hand tell you how many books I've ever finished. And it was probably because I had to for some sort of qualification or exam. So yeah, it was never really something for me. So I think you're spot on there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, even accountancy with numbers, right? I think it's just, you know, I think you're much better with people. So, you know, not being, I can see that's just a natural flaw. And by the way, I'm like, I get it because I first wanted to be a doctor, or I say I want to be a doctor. I'm a son of immigrants, so of course I have to be a doctor, right? and then I scuffed up my GCSE. So then I was like, right, well, I guess that's a lawyer then. Yeah. And then I scuffed up my A-levels. Oh, yeah. But the irony is that actually now I know, now I see what lawyers do day in, day out. I married someone who was qualified as a solicitor. Of course, that was the wrong thing for me. I would have absolutely hated being a lawyer, you know, like that level of attention to detail and all the rest of it. It would just drive me insane.
Yeah, the focus as well of those professionals in that space. You said lawyers, doctors, accountants, I mean, take my hat off to them. It's impressive that harder work in that kind of manner is, you know, is impressive.
Yeah.
You look a bit like a doctor, to be fair.
I don't know. I think I'm quite good at bullshit. So, you know, like if you ever see me in a white lab coat, run. but like, let's talk about the sort of the beginnings at NS, you know, like what's it like going in as a sort of fresh grad into what's become quite a successful, mortgage brokerage or commercial finance brokerage, you know, under also a couple of industry legends in Hugh and Isla as well. What was it like joining Ennis and, you know, kind of being very wet behind the ears and not really having a clue what you're doing?
It was, I've kind of always been, I like a challenge. It was fairly eye-opening for me at the start. I was just, you know, in this environment, but I'd never been in, you know, I'd worked at university, I worked in shops and that kind of thing, but I'd never been in sort of an office environment and walked into a room and seen people and people look at you like, you know, who the hell's this new guy? Who the hell's that lanky twat? That's probably what most of them are thinking. But I'd say, first of all, I was incredibly fortunate. Hugh and Isla were great. I think they had a period where they probably weren't so too sure about me. But I was very, very fortunate in that I was good at talking to people, always been very good at talking to people. So my first job was on the phone, so just calling up people. So within reason, I think if you build rapport with someone, they don't mind too much if you don't know what they're talking about. So that I thought I was quite good at, quite quick at. I realized that I didn't want to do that for very long. So I knew what I had to do to not be that person anymore. You know, on your point about graduates, there were quite a few of us. There were quite a few of us, you know, young guys in there coming in at the same time. And, you know, one of which now works for me, two of which did work for me. So we kind of founded some friendships there and stuff like that. So we kind of were lucky, or certainly I was lucky, that progression was very, very quick. There was an opportunity where Ennis had had a bridging department, I remember, for a very small period of time. And there was the kind of commercial and development department, which is, was run by, or was run by two guys, one of which very, very well known to, you know, to the industry. I call him a bit of an industry dinosaur now, but Chris Whitney.
I know Chris, yeah.
And I didn't, to be honest, I didn't have a relationship with him very quickly. He, you know, they were one side of the room, we were the other. But the other half of that partnership, Rob Haywood, he left the business very soon after I joined. Maybe I'd been there for probably about 2 months. And credit to Hugh and Isla, what those guys do very well, I'd say, or did very well then, certainly, you know, I haven't been in the business for a long time, was take people they had within the business and say, right, that person can probably fill this hole. It, you know, part of it's probably from a cost perspective, it's a much, much cheaper way to do that. You might not get experience, but you get someone who's probably driven and kind of try and fill that role. So that's what I did. And I went into that role and, you know, start meeting guys like yourself and just tried to learn as quickly as possible. But I was certainly fortunate to have had that step. I know some other people who came into business just after me who stayed in that role, what we call client services, you know, telephone salesman, basically, in so many ways, stayed in that role for a year and a half before they were given progression. And I also think I was very lucky to be given progression into the specialist space. I don't think, a bit like an accountant, I don't think the standard space would have suited my personality.
You know, when you say standard, you mean like regulated
mortgages? Yeah, right? Regulated mortgages. What I would call, you know, more of a processing role, yeah, behind a screen, maybe lots of time still on the phone, but you're not meeting people, seeing sites, you know, sitting down. You don't meet the lender. You know, I'd have a phone call with you and go, you know, Mr. Barclays, Michael, how are you? Will you do this mortgage? It's like, you know, computer, yeah, says no, put it through the computer, look at the step. So I think I was also very fortunate there. And yeah, so that was that stage to starting my broking journey.
How did you find winning clients at, you know, what would have been, what, 22, 23, 24 years old, trying to go out and persuade, you know, men and women, probably mostly men, but though, who are probably mostly middle-aged, to take a chance on you to go and help them find financing for their schemes? Like, I think
Ennis's biggest strength always was a fantastic brand. I always used to say to people, and, you know, this is nothing against them, and they built a brilliant business doing this, I always used to say to people that the branding and marketing gave you this image of this hugely successful business, which is hugely, you know, well experienced in all these sorts of scenarios. But really, when you had a look under the hood, there was kind of lots of young people who sort of didn't have the experience to know exactly the right way to deal with things. But what we did have was drive. You know, everyone wanted to make money. Everyone wanted to be successful. Everyone wanted to complete deals. And everyone kind of helped each other out. And I think that's where I had Chris, who eventually took a liking to me and sort of, he'd probably say, taught me everything I knew, but he certainly taught me a hell of a lot. And interestingly, the first deal, I remember it, the first deal I ever completed was a very standard semi-commercial mortgage with Interbay for a lady client who I had been introduced to by her son. And I think I needed that deal to probably get done just before Hugh and Isla were going to get rid of me. So I think it just about came in time.
Skin of your teeth, basically. Yeah.
And
was that a golfing buddy by any chance? Someone who played golf?
No, I can't remember where it came from. You know, it could have just been a standard introduction through the business. I mean, the guy, actually, funnily enough, is now a buying agent. We did quite a lot of business with and work with. But yeah, that was kind of where it came from. And it probably did, you know, people say it saved me. Certain people in the business, Hugh and Isla have never said that to me, but certain other senior management in the business kind of told me, who I went into business, one of them I went into business with later down the line, sort of told me that, yeah, you were quite close there. And the culture of that business was very much make or break. You know, it was like, I think we sat down in the pub one evening and went through the number of people that had been there, a few of us since we'd been there. And it was very, very quick turnover type of business. You know, people left to set up their own businesses. People left to go to another brokerage. People didn't do well enough and didn't make the cut, that sort of thing. So it was cutthroat, but it was a brilliant environment. And to be honest with you, it's one I would love my business to take certain cultures out of, because I look back at the times very, very fondly, and it was really, really good times. Not to mention, you know, family-wise, met my future wife and mother of my child at that business. So it holds a lot of good memories for me.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely a nice bonus. That's for sure. that's really cool. I actually don't think, I know we've had a couple of romantic dalliances at Avonmore, but I don't think we've had, we've not had any offspring coming about.
the next generation of.
Purely because the business existed, yeah. But I guess we ought to give it time.
we were the first. I think I saw Isla recently at a rugby match and we're having this conversation. I think we were the first. There is another one, I think, on its way or close to.
Okay, that's cool.
But I think we were the first, and their business must be 08-ish, so nearly 20 years old. So yeah. give it time, and I'm sure you'll get a bit of more offspring.
Yeah. Well, we actually had, I actually want to give a shout out to Sophia Lee. She had one of our relationship managers. She had a baby last week. At the weekend. So we're absolutely delighted for her and her partner. Lovely to have another baby join the Avonmore fold.
But it's the gilet in the post.
We do have baby gilets. I'm just looking at Kim now. Kim's nodding at me. So yeah, we do actually have baby gilets for Nipper. So it's quite a cool one.
The guys in the office got me this. At the Masters, they all wear those white overalls. The caddies.
Yeah.
The guys in the office got me this fantastic Masters branded with a Portway on it. Uniform for the little guy. So he's not quite big enough yet, but I think he's getting close.
Well, you want them to have something to grow into rather than because you get them that newborn size and they grow out of it so fast.
5 minutes.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by J3 Advisory. J3 understands the unique insurance challenges that lenders face and are committed to providing solutions that offer peace of mind and financial security. Their expert advice helps you make better, faster decisions about your insurance program. Interested in a CPD session to update your teams on the current insurance landscape, or need precise and practical insurance advice for life schemes? Get in touch with J3 Advisory. Learn more at j3advisory.co.uk. J3 Advisory is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. So what was the progression like before you went from being in the NS West Hampstead office, working with Chris on the commercial stuff, to basically setting up the Central London office for them? Like, how did that come about?
So that was, kind of myself and, you know, another guy at NS, we got to the stage where we maybe outgrown the place, or not, you know, necessarily in terms of ability, but just in terms of a challenge. And so we always sat down and said, look, let's do something ourselves. You're a residential mortgage guy. You're a regulated guy. I'm specialist guy. What can we do? You know, let's bring us together and let's see what we can do. And so we then progressed into, funnily enough, through a guy from another lender, introduced us to a firm based in Manchester called Watts. So Watts Commercial had their business up in just outside of Manchester, up that way. And we met with those guys that ran that business, and we said to them, we all got on and said, look, we'll open your London office for you, try and grow that team, you know, get you kind of boots on the ground down here and kind of go from there. That was a big step. It was tough. You know, COVID hit probably 10 months into that journey. And you'll know, you know, with your experience, that starting a business and building a book of clients, etc., takes probably 3 months to do that part, and then another 3 to 6 months to do kind of get the pipeline through and get deals on the books and start to come through. So that came at a tough time, but I think, you know, as you know, and everyone knows, very, very quickly that turned into, you know, my God, what were you all going to do? You know, this business is, you know, doomed. This is all over, to stamp duty reductions and the world going absolutely nuts. So things kind of then picked up very, very quickly from there. That didn't work out, not as a business. You know, me and my business partner exited that business, and left those guys, the original owners, to keep running that business, which is still going, a part of their bigger brand. But there was just things that the experiences we had, I'd say is the best way to put it, compared to the experiences they had of the way they wanted to run the business, we wanted to run the business. And it was a really nice halfway house, and it taught me a lot about running a business. And it was a good halfway house for that, but it wasn't kind of, it wasn't like your baby, you know. It was like, we have our own branding, we have our own marketing, this is our strategy, I know it works, so follow this strategy.
But what, you didn't have, so like at that time, sorry to interrupt, but you didn't have, like, you were basically being told by Phil and his guys, look, this is how we do it, yeah, and you need to just follow that. So you didn't really have agency in that environment.
Yeah, correct. And it was very, very different to the sort of Ennis model. You take the Ennis model, which was marketing, generate fantastic business, hold on to all of those fees and retain that business, you know, direct consumer business, speaking to the clients, etc. And then the Watts business was more, okay, speak to brokers who don't facilitate commercial transactions and help them and get the business from them. So you're kind of going very, very quickly B2B, but then you're also paying away a lot of your fees to those businesses. So, you know, one's very introducer led, and then one was totally unintroducer led at all. But what was really, really good for me, I think, is I understood both sides of that business. Mm-hmm. I got to learn, looking back at Ennis, I didn't really learn at the time because you don't tend to pay attention to where's this business coming from when you're not a business owner. Mm-hmm. You just take the business, deal with the business and do it. But then I got to see the other side. And I think that is what made me really, really want to have a business that deals with both those types of things and can deal with, you know, B2B, helping out other brokers or helping out estate agents, you know, accountants, IFAs, etc. But also have a decent brand, a brand that people recognize and want to deal with in terms of a direct consumer point of view.
What's your, so obviously we'll talk about how the genesis of Portway in a second, but what would you say the split is between, I suppose, introducer-led business and direct business at the moment that you have?
Yeah, Portway? The numbers last year, roughly about 35% introducer-led business. I think that probably number was, in a good year, maybe we'll be closer to 50-50. But I think, you know, a lot of professionals have kind of spent the last couple of years in our sector that's tough, you know, dealing with other things, being busy, talking about, you know, IFAs, whether it be stocks and shares, whatever, and not having time to kind of do that cross sell or focus on what that might be. But I think 60-40 roughly is a nice number, you know, 60% direct to consumer. It's really nice dealing with professionals sometimes, you know. You'll have seen it, probably feel like it's the brokers that are slowing it down, but, you know, just having documents on hand, having everyone, you know, what's this? Do you have this? You know, having all of that there coming across to you when you need it as a kind of middleman, middleman, but is a really enjoyable way to do business. And I think you can form more business and a longer lasting relationship. You know, how the standard property investor might buy, or someone, let's say, who's not a full-time property landlord, as in they have another job, someone who is, let's say, a lawyer, might have three buy-to-let properties in their own house. So you're going to be dealing with, you know, a mortgage every 2 to 5 years, a remortgage every 2 to 5 years, and maybe a purchase every 2 to 5 years. That's not going to, you know, that's not, you can't build a business off the back of that.
You need a lot of them to build any business with scale. Yeah.
Yeah. But you get the scale through that middleman of that introducer.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I see the parallels between us and, you know, for ourselves as well, which is that we do deals directly with developers. But, you know, if you think about, a bit like you said, a developer is going to be doing between one and three projects a year. Some of those projects will be of size or a criteria that don't fit what you do. Or they might, like at the moment, they might be out of the market because, you know, they're struggling to sell schemes, and they, you know, and they've got equity tied up in them, so they can't go and buy, or they just don't want to buy because they think that the land prices are too high and are waiting for them to fall and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you can invest time, business development time in those relationships, or you can invest the time in people who effectively are aggregating those people for you. Yeah. Right. And so there's a clear business logic in dealing with introducers and intermediaries in that context. So I completely see the merits of that.
I think the other thing, and we've been guilty of this, as I'm sure everyone has, is having a couple of clients you rely on too heavily.
Yeah.
You have a client you rely on heavily, something changes, you know, they go bust, or they decide, I had, you know, one that went bust last year, it was a fairly big client, and I've got one this year who's turned around to me this year and said, I'm just kind of a bit bored of this. Like, you know, don't blame them, the market's been tough. I'm a bit bored of this. This will probably be the last project, pack it in. And that's, you don't get that with intermediaries because you've got that much wider network. And I also think you don't get that with a solid platform where you're generating direct leads like Ennis had, because you've got a constant flow of new people coming through. The other great one with the intermediaries is the fact that, and those introducers, you kind of get pre-qualified.
Yeah.
You don't get, I would just like a chat, which, you know, we do lots of and is a great thing to do, but you sort of get that as well, which I think is great.
You spend, you know, you spend your 25 quid per Google AdWord or whatever, whatever it is, right? And of course, the, you know, you can get a big flurry of inquiries, but how many of those are complete tire kicker time wasters, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, Kim's obviously in the room. She runs our marketing. There's no way in hell we'd spend money on Google AdWords for bridging those, because we'd burn through a lot of money doing and waste a lot of time trying to acquire those clients. I mean, just speaking about Watts, there was some recent news about them being acquired. It was quite funny because I interviewed Phil Gray from Watts back in September 23, and I asked him about M&A, and he flatly denied that was of any interest to him. and of course, most likely conversations were already beginning around that. Yeah, sure. So yeah, I think he was being very coy. What do you, you know, from, you know, like we're happy to have spicy conversations, but, you know, we all have to occupy the same world. What do you make of that, of that bit of, you know, that acquisition, you know, or that bit of M&A? You know, do you think that we're seeing, obviously we saw Corico being acquired by OneDome as well, and we had Monty on. We actually released Monty's episode this week, our second episode this week. I mean, what do you think of M&A in the brokerage space at the moment, and what do you make of the Watts acquisition? You know, just having been in that organization for a couple of years,
I think, you know, Phil and I had our differences.
Yeah.
I exchanged some very, very nice words with him last week when I heard the news, and he was, you know, very, very complimentary of me and what I've managed to achieve, and what said, you know, let me help you out, that sort of thing. If you need anything, let me know. I think it's hard to understand it without knowing numbers.
Mm.
You know, I said to you earlier, I'm a numbers guy, but there obviously is the element of, it's an interesting market. Very, very quickly, if you start becoming a loss-making business, you have a bad year, what have you, or you have to shrink, then you can't exit. So I totally understand, you know, the opportunity for M&A, and I want to be a similar business that does consider M&A, but I think there is a time of getting it right. I think there's a lot of things that can be bolted on to businesses in our space. You know, the use of technology, you know, look at the lending model, you look at a business like Enra, you know, you see where that business has been and got to, and what a fantastic job Danny's done with that business. And sure, the other guys involved in the business. Hard for me to say to you, it's a really great deal. I mean, you know, well done to them, but numbers would be interesting. You know, I think one we can talk about, one we know the numbers of, is obviously be SPF.
Yeah.
It was 70 something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Roughly speaking, the number, which, you know, that seems a good deal. I think they've still got Lenco they held onto separately. Mm. But yeah, it seems to be a very attractive space for you know, larger companies to be acquiring, if you think about a process of a journey, and if you've got an estate agency, an accountancy firm, an IFA, maybe a commercial agent, and then a brokerage, you kind of have covered all your financial services there, and you can probably scale very, very quickly, maybe insurance as well on the back of that. Yeah.
Well, I think you mentioned SPF, but I think one of the things that I hadn't appreciated, I think it was Rob Jupp that told me, was that what wasn't often that spoken about was that SPF had a significant insurance business. And I think a lot of the enterprise value of SPF was actually from the insurance business rather than the mortgage business. But, you know, like I was, one of the things that came up with Monty and others is that actually commercial mortgage brokerages don't have huge enterprise value. And, you know, I don't know where you stand on that, but my personal view is that actually they are undervalued because, you know, ultimately they are very effective lead generators for a wider, more complementary business. But I think on a standalone basis, it's, it is more difficult, obviously, to sustain.
Yeah, I think half the problem, I'd say, with traditional, or look, I'm not saying this as someone who's like, oh, I'm, you know, the young guy on the block, I'm, you know, better at technology, data, all that kind of thing, because I'm not especially. But I think a lot of people, or brokers previously, you know, even great successful brokers, you know, they dealt with stuff, paperwork, they did a deal. I remember, and I won't say, you know, you probably guess, but I won't say the firm I was at, but I remember being at a firm and saying to the owner of business, like, you know, what do you do with product transfers? And, you know, speaking to clients and reminding them that their fixed rate is going to expire, and even something as simple as that. And he sort of looked at me after running this business for a long period of time and went, that's a great idea. I kind of thought, hold on a second. But he ran a fantastic business. You know, we probably all know who I'm talking about. It's not hard. But he ran a fantastically profitable business. But I think that integration of technology and data wasn't there. So you saying to me, look, there's all these cross-selling opportunities, but if you don't have the data, then how can you use those opportunities to cross-sell? Do you know what I mean? So I think they are undervalued. I think there is value, but I also think there is value on holding on to them until you've managed to achieve something like you say with SPF, with the intrinsic value in the insurance book. One of the biggest problems with mortgages is they come around every 2 to 5 years. Or if you do a development, you might have a client that does 3 developments a year, but he has to find a new development to do. And once he does it, he sells it. He's not, sometimes they do, of course, but they're not, it's not like invoice discounting, or it's not like, you know, home insurance, whatever it might be, or being an accountant and getting year after year fees. We're not paid on a retainer. Client developers don't take us under the wing and go, right, we'll pay you X amount per annum and you're our finance advisor. We wouldn't want that because then you're tied to them, and they wouldn't want that because if they're not doing any projects, they don't want to be paying you. So I think, you know, coming back to the question, that they are undervalued, but I think if you can get the cross-selling and data correct, I think that's where the value is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, you know, but even if you just specialize in bridging and development, for example, or specialist, you know, you've got acquisition bridge, development exit, possibly the buy to let on the back end. This idea that I see it as I've seen it because we've been part of that kind of journey with a number of schemes. You know, we've got a deal that, I mean, it's hanging around a bit like a bad smell now, but yeah, you know, we've got a deal that we've been involved with for the best part of 5 years. You know, people, you know, when we have, you know, people who are interested in talking to us about M&A, and they go, well, you know, you only have 12-month duration, and to be like, well, let me just, you know, let me just walk you through like a lot of how this really works. This notion that it's not, I mean, I do appreciate it. With a lender, it's a little bit different. You know, you are constantly fed deals by your introducer base, and so there is a kind of a bit of a conveyor belt. But you know, kind of brokerage side, I don't think it's that different.
Do you think, out of interest, sorry to interrupt you, that is why you see a lot of bridging lenders going into buy to let finance, because that gives them, you know, a book that's, you know, a 5-10 year book, something that's a longer period of time, rather than loans that they're in and out of?
I you know, I think that there, one of the things that is one of the things that sets us a bit apart from a lot of other specialist lenders is, you know, we don't have a balance sheet. We're not a balance sheet lender. That means we're incredibly nimble, and it also means that if someone wants to acquire us, that all they have to diligence is the operating platform and the contracts and the arrangements and what have you. Other specialist lenders, they have to raise equity and then they have to get a wholesale line that goes behind that. And as soon as you raise equity, the only, you know, you're effectively then valued on a multiple of your net book value, and the multiple for that multiple on that net book value is very low for bridging because of the duration, and then it increases when you have a longer duration, so in buy-to-let. But the flip side is that the margins in buy-to-let are incredibly skinny. So then you have to be hitting massive volumes to make that work. But then that creates another issue, which, by the way, the advance rates are much better on buy-to-let than they are on specialists. But that then still creates other issues, other headaches, which is that you then max out your equity, you max out your wholesale facility, and the only way that you can continue to grow is by raising money. So, you know, we've seen a number of our peers where I think that the owners of those organizations they've eventually had to give away so much of the equity in their businesses to be able to lend increasing large amounts of money, albeit very, very, very thin margins, that they are. Then their ownership of those organizations is so small now that they are effectively glorified employees. So that, you know, and I think it's a bit of a slippery slope, actually, that transition into buy to let. If you have to, I think the only way to do it is if you can do that in some sort of, you know, in some sort of off balance sheet model, in my opinion, because otherwise you effectively will end up becoming marginalized as, you know, as the owner manager, effectively. So
I think the margin thing is an interesting point you make. I have the conversation every now and then. I had it quite recently with a client who sort of said, you know, they looked at a redemption statement for a bridging lender and sort of said, wow, you know, they borrowed this much from me, I'm paying them this huge amount of money. And when you look at the numbers, you think, yeah, you're not wrong there, but what you're missing is the fact that most bridging lenders, you know, they're borrowing money from elsewhere. It's not balance sheet lending that they're just turning over their own capital. They're borrowing money from elsewhere. And actually, if you had a look at the margin after they've paid a broker, staff, whatever, the margins are very low. They're not, you know, we're not looking at, you know, 12% per annum returns. Mm. You're not even probably looking at 3% return once you factor in all the costs.
I would say that for some of the people who are very bridge oriented, they make probably under 2% margin a year on that business. I mean, look, we know some, you know, that historically some of our peers have lent effectively at the cost of borrowing, and their entire business model is predicated on default interest, effectively the borrower getting in, you know, late repayment charges. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's a very well known Manchester based firm that you go one day over and they charge you 5%. You know,
who's that?
Well, we won't name them, but you know, but they aren't the only ones that do that. You know, and it's a maddening practice.
I guess there's pressures as well from funding lines, you know, with non-utilization, if you have a funding line with non-utilization costs, etc., to get money out the door. It's an interesting one because, you know, I've always thought, talking about the fact of, you know, starting a lender, having a lender bolted on, because talking about M&A and you look at the businesses that have been effective, you know, being West One and Enterprise, now Aria, etc., you think, you know, that business generates its own business, plus it lends its own money.
Yeah.
I think it's a very, very good model. And it surprises me, to be honest with you, that more lenders don't either start a brokerage or acquire a brokerage. I know there's a bit of a grey area. You don't want to upset other brokers. You know, you want to remain impartial and all that sort of thing. But it does surprise me that it's not happened more.
Yeah. I think that there's, I think the danger you always have as a if you know, if you, you know, whichever way you go, whether you go lender acquiring broker or setting up a broker or vice versa, and obviously seen a, you know, a well-known packager based in Birmingham, set up a lending arm, and I think there was a lot of, we'll say, outcry about it, because you know there are always going to be accusations of cherry picking, that you know it's almost like if you as a lender get a deal from that brokerage, your first question is, right, well, I'm getting this. Why am I getting this? Is it because the deal's not good enough for your own in-house money? You know, so that it definitely raises levels of suspicion. I think that in the case of West One Enterprise, for example, I think they've done a very good job of kind of walking that tightrope. But I think that it's definitely not easy to do. And certainly one of the reasons why I'd be reluctant to, you know, to be setting up a brokerage, you know, out of Avonmore. But, you know, notwithstanding that, though, you can definitely see the flywheel effect benefits of that from, you know, from a brokerage space, and that's why I like the commercial finance brokerage or resi mortgage brokerage, because you effectively, it's almost like, you can almost treat it like a loss leader if you've got the insurance and insurance brokerage, if you've got IFA, if you've got an accountancy, if you've got an estate agency business or commercial agency business, and so on and so forth. And certainly I know others who are doing. I'm very very close with James McGregor, who have interviewed on the podcast. That's certainly the model. He's gone down the accountancy and, you know, commercial resi brokerage. He's got, you know, he's starting to work on insurance. He's got insurance business. He's got an IFA lined up. You know, this is all quite interesting, quite logical way of growing and developing the business. I mean, I guess, you know, like, you know, going back to Portway, the genesis of Portway, what was the trigger for you and your business partner to set Portway up?
I think a little bit probably was our frustration of, you know, having worked, you know, with two different businesses that did things in two different ways. Our frustration probably was wanting to bring those two things together, but also was wanting to really, like I said to you earlier, it was a halfway house. It wasn't a thing we put our own stamp on. It wasn't, you know, we didn't decide small things. We didn't decide the name. We didn't decide, you know, our accountant. We didn't decide all those sorts of things. So it was wanting to have a business that was truly ours. You know, and unfortunately, my journey with that business partner came to an end about a year and a half after the business, and I acquired his shareholding in the business. Mm. We just had different views, to be honest, of where the business wanted to go. But it was one I always wanted to grow, and probably one that he didn't want to grow as much. I think a brokerage can be a very, very good cash flow business, but you have to probably make a lot of sacrifices if you have the goal of, you know, M&A one day, or you have the goal of growing the business, and in terms of staff numbers, in terms of, you know, revenue. I think, you know, I often look back at, you know, times I was wouldn't say happiest, but at times I enjoyed the industry the most, and it was probably when I was just broking myself, self-employed, working for Ennis, when I was just doing deals, getting out there, you know, celebrating on the success of getting deals done. I think I overlook that success now of doing deals. It doesn't give me the same buzz. What does give me the buzz now is seeing other people enjoy that moment that, you know, you get your first big deal done, you get another deal done, whatever it might be. That's what I really enjoy, and that's the kind of culture that I experienced at Ennis, and the kind of similar culture that I want within Portway. We got a really, really great team. I'm really, really proud of the guys, you know, and everything they do. I'd say we're a pretty young team. But hiring, you know, you'll know this, you don't often see in this industry a very experienced broker move brokerage or move platform or set up their own thing. Because once you've got your pipeline, it's very, very hard to say, look, I'm going to risk letting this pipeline go to go and start something else. So, yeah, you know, that's the training of young brokers is always something that's quite difficult. But I think if you've got the right people, then it can become very easy.
What's the, I mean, it's interesting hearing you talk about, you know, how you and your business partner split. And interestingly, someone that I know who's been with his business partner for a long time, they are basically going to have to separate because, you know, there's a bit of an age gap between them. One's really hungry, really ambitious. The younger one, obviously. The other partner's older, slightly different stage in their lives. You know, kids are starting uni or the rest of it. And you know, the older guy, he wants, you know, comfortable, cozy lifestyle business, and isn't prepared to make the sacrifices and plow the money back into the business that the younger guy is willing to do, because, you know, for I guess kind of human, natural, obvious reasons. But you know, it just isn't willing to take the risk and isn't willing to make the sacrifice. But I think that it's, you know, and it's fascinating to hear your example, because actually, you know, you and your former business partner, he was probably quite happy to be broking himself on the tools, and, you know, enjoying the cash and just having a nice lifestyle. You've taken a slightly different approach, which is actually, do you know what, you've basically taken the view, right, I want to work on my business, not in my business.
Yeah.
But the downside of working on the business is that for the period of time as you're growing it up, is that you're having to give away more of the revenue of that business to the people that are working in the business, and you're not able to do the broking yourself as well to make money. So
100%. And you know, I often think to myself, you know, I've got a business development manager within the business, and he'll say to me, look, I've got this guy who's come to me. He probably, you know, your experience would be great. You probably should deal with him, because I still do some broking. But I look at that, and you look at the revenue, you think, well, if I give that over, I know it's pretty straightforward. I could probably tell you the best lender for it now, or certainly a handful of them. And really, it might be bridging loans. It's pretty vanilla, and it's going to buy an X amount of money. But in the long run, I need to be concentrate on growing the business. Where's the next lead coming from? Where's our next member of staff coming from? Is the process as refined as it can be? You know, and that's, I think, the stage that we're at the moment. But it's tough for me. I would say some people might look at me and say, you know, he's an entrepreneur. That's like, he's got entrepreneurial qualities and all that sort of thing. I would probably disagree with that. I am at heart a sales guy. I am at heart, you know, a people person, which obviously, you know, these are qualities that entrepreneurs need to have. But, you know, there's lots of qualities of an entrepreneur that I probably don't traditionally have and have to sort of had taught myself. But I think you hit the nail on the head in your example of, you said, of someone else you spoke to. It was a very, very similar position. You know, there was a big age gap between us. He had kids. I was lucky enough, you know, I don't mean that in a weird way. I was lucky enough not to have children, so I could spend all my time working on the business. You know, I could go home and carry on working, doing spreadsheets, whatever it might be, thinking of ideas and stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. That is what I had, and I was probably lucky to have that. So yeah, we just needed to go in different directions, to be honest. I would have been happy, and I did make him the offer to carry on being a broker within the business, but he decided against that, and I think it's probably the right idea. I think he needed a fresh start, and I needed a fresh start. And very quickly after that, we started hiring people. The business grew from when he left. There was four of us in total to what is eight of us now. And yeah, as you said, there's a lot of working on the business is a very tough thing to do at times, because you want to still be involved. You want to still do deals. But I also think, and I had this conversation with, you know, probably one of the most successful people within the industry, who said to me, look, whatever you do, make sure you still do some broking, because you've still got to keep your finger on the pulse. You still got to understand, you know, do Avonmore still want ground up development? Do they still do finish and exit? All that sort of thing. Whereas I had a period where I would say I didn't do that. And very, very quickly, I looked at some deals and just thought, I just can't remember what to do. You know, not what to do, but what lenders to approach. You know as well as I do, this lender's appetite changes overnight. and also the lenders that exist changes overnight at some stage. So yeah, it's a tough balance.
Yeah. That growth in headcount, where do you see that, like, where do you see that going in the short to medium term? Are you still actively looking to hire people and bring people into the team?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main thing I wanted to complete was to have the full process. So yeah, that is point of entry of lead to exit, and then in terms of servicing that exit and everything in between, so, you know, broker, admin, whatever. I believe I have that team now to be able to execute that.
Yeah.
But we, you know, I'm desperate to take on more people. But finding good people is tough.
And are they directly employed, or are you looking at a self-employed model as well?
There's only one person left in the business who is self-employed. I'm not the biggest fan of the self-employed model.
Okay.
I think, yeah, I understand the, you know, the short-term gains for the employer. I mean, especially start looking at national insurance tax and contribution increases, etc. But if, you know, I want to sell this business before I'm 40, that's, you know, the idea. So it gives me about 8.5 years to do that. Yeah, if you're trying to sell a business that has 15 self-employed brokers, what's tying them to that?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. What's your value? Well, your value is the database, but, you know, everyone knows, everyone's clever enough to know that people don't go elsewhere and go, well, you know, I was self-employed there, and, you know, you're self-employed, there's no real tie. So no, very much trying to employ. But employment's tough. I'd say, you know, it's not something I'm particularly good at, I'd probably say.
What's the, you know, where have you got people from before? Like, what's the profile of someone that's coming in? Are you trying to take them in quite early on, get them through their CMAP, and then, you know, and then grow into becoming a broker, or are you taking some lateral hires as well?
I think it's quite interesting. You go through phases of, like, phases where you think, like, I could do with more of those people. Like, they're great, that they're driven, you know, not beat around the bush. They're cheap, much, much cheaper than someone else who's experienced and already on, you know, 40, 50, 60% commission elsewhere, whatever it might be, plus a salary. So there's pitfalls, you know, to both, but I think we've done the sort of more junior roles, not roles, but more junior, hiring more junior people.
Yeah.
And I think now we probably need some, you know, real experience on the ground. I mean, I'm really keen to get in someone who's specifically experienced in development finance, which I think is really tough. I think I probably do all the development finance within the business at the moment, but there's a big difference between dealing with a client who's trying to build four houses and they just want some fairly straightforward terms to trying to deal with a institution who is building, you know, a 70 unit build to rent scheme, or a, you know, 150 unit PBSA scheme. But, you know, those people are tough to hire.
Yeah.
I kind of, looking to the lending space, I think in terms of staff, I think guys that work for development lenders, you know, they understand transactions. They understand what lenders want to hear. They understand what, you know, information to provide. And I think that's a good way forward. Even I know guys that have gone from, you know, you call one side the dark side and one the other, or both the dark side, one side of the dark side to the other. And I think that's where you probably get the experience from.
I think from what I hear, it's, you know, it's easier to go from lender to broker than the other way around. And yeah, I mean, we've even tried to hire someone directly out of brokerage. So I can't say that with any experience.
You don't want us.
Something that I hear from some of your peers is that, you know, a bit like you said, you know, a good, you know, trying to get a good senior hire on the brokerage side, if they're willing to move, you've got to raise an eyebrow, because, like you say, they're walking away from probably a pretty good setup. They're walking away from pipeline, so on and so forth. And then you've got to deal with the, you know, they've got to manage their conflicts, they've got to manage their client book, and then, you know, how much of that can they actually bring across? And before you know it, they've got to completely start again, and you effectively have 12-month redundancy, which is kind of pointless from your perspective. Do you, you know, some of the ways that to get the really best people in the industry, from the the conversations I have with your peers who are owners of, you know, small, medium-sized brokerages, is that you have to effectively offer the top people some sort of equity participation or partnership in the business. Is that something that you're thinking about? Is this something that's coming up in conversations with the senior people that you're trying to bring into the business? Like, how does that come across?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I think what's interesting is, I think one thing you can really sell is sort of culture, the environment, you know, all that side of things. I think what's scary sometimes is, you know, I hired someone recently and they told me what another brokerage was offering them in terms of commission. And they were self-employed and it wasn't a self-employed basis. But some of the numbers you'd hear about, you know, we're talking 70% is what the number was said that was being offered. And I just think to myself, once you look at the overhead, once you look at, you know, whatever it might be, your PI insurance, all these things added in together, where's the margin?
That's pointless.
It's a hard one because you look at, sometimes you might be able to hire someone on that large figure who actually is going to boost your profile as a business, because people are going to think, wow, you know, so-and-so's moved to Portway. Like, that's impressive. Like, it's a good move. And you can also then harness that person's knowledge into your younger staff. I think maybe even like, you know, Chris Whitney at Ennis is a good example.
Yeah.
He may not have been the most profitable person for them in terms of margin. Obviously, you know, he did some good numbers, so that's different. But what he did do is, you know, share his wealth of experience. So I think it certainly is a tough one.
Yeah.
Some of the numbers of pay are just silly when you look at the percentages. And I think it goes back to me saying is, you know, when was the best times? People might look at me now and say, you know, must be making more money, more successful than he ever was in his career. But, you know, probably the period I was making the most money is when I was that person who was being offered that commission just to, you know, not have, you could still go on holiday and not think about the business.
It's really funny because I still think probably, you know, like you sometimes take for granted the success, but, you know, when I look back to say like 2018, we'd just taken on our first institutional funding line, things were just starting to take off and get a little bit easier, get a little bit better. But, you know, there were still only 7 or 8 of us. You know, these were simpler times.
Yeah.
You know, these are simpler times. And, you know, I just still remember being in my kitchen going, is this as good as it gets? And in lots of ways, obviously lots of things got bigger and got more exciting, but, you know, things got more complicated as well. So, like, I totally get that.
I think as well on your, you know, your point about hiring people, it's very tough, I think, in the environment that's been created post-COVID, the working from home environment. Not that I have a specific problem with people doing that, but if you look at my example of, you know, bringing in someone very senior because you think it will impression well on, you know, your more junior members of staff, for example. Yeah, but, you know, if they're expected to work from home all the time, then what good's that to you? You know, you need them, that person to be in the business. And I think we're at that stage of the business where people need to be in. I want to build that culture where people are bouncing ideas off each other, talking to each other, you know, similar to what I've had in my career. And I just think, you know, a lot of people are applying for jobs and wanting jobs not on that basis. You know, they want to know what's in it for me. What's, you know, how many days a week can I work from home? I'm sure it's the same as you. I mean, how many interviews you have, the first question is how many days a week can I work from home? Not the greatest.
No. Well, we'll maybe touch on some of that in part two. I think what we'll do now is we'll call a break here, and we'll invite everyone to watch and listen for the next bit. If you can hang on for a week for part two. Just want to say thank you to Callum for joining us here today. Callum, where can people find you on the internet if they can find you at all?
You can find me at portway-finance.co.uk or on my LinkedIn, or if you like wine over on Instagram, maybe.
That's great. Also want to give a shout out to J3 Advisory and Avonmore Capital, the show and the series sponsors respectively. Thanks very much to them. And you can find me on the internet. I'm Michael Dean, and you can find me at property_funder across the various social platforms. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks and goodbye.